These are real people. They do have struggles.
And it starts to get on my nerves. I just shut down.
So many people suffer from mental illness.
To get the word out that men have got to start talking.
A lot of people don't understand the depth of the situation, so they can't appreciate,
It's difficult dealing with our minds, and the suicidal thoughts were back.
People knew that there was something not right, but they just never really said anything or probably felt like it wasn't their place to say anything.
You're not depressed, it's all in your head. That's probably the statement I've had people say the most.
I mean, this shit is real, and it's hard, it's exhausting.
Sometimes you need somebody to just give you permission.
And I think people realize how helpful that one conversation can be just to figure out why you are feeling the way you are.
Not only did this help me to write it, it potentially might have helped some other people as well. So it sort of started from there.
People just want to know that they're safe to talk and share these things.
So many people think they're alone. And then you hear other people talk about it and they think, oh, that's so brave, or I could relate to that. And then they want to talk about it.
Hello and welcome to the Open Journal podcast. I hope you're well. I hope things are going amazing for you right now. I'm delighted to say that in this episode, we're joined by a new guest. Simon is going to be with us today. We're going to hear a little bit about some of his work, his insights, his expertise around being a psychotherapist, but also an author. We're going to be talking a little bit about breaking bad patterns. We talk about decoding, the links to our behavior, implicit memories. Like, there's a real mixture in our conversation, from both kind of internal thinking and processing our behavior and the links to our support networks and the friends and the people that we interact with as well. A big thank you to Simon for coming on and sharing his insights, expertise and knowledge. And I really hope you enjoy listening into this one, and it gives an opportunity to maybe reflect on some of the things that we each do and how we act and how some of the things that have happened in our past affect what we're doing today. It's just a really interesting conversation. As always, I hope you enjoy this episode, and if you do, please do leave a review on your podcast platform of choice. Leaving a 5-star review really does help other people discover this podcast, the conversations and the signposting that happens here as well. Equally, if you enjoy listening and think, maybe I could be the next Simon, then have a look at the website, which is openjournalbc.com, and you can find information about being a guest there as well. There's been so many guests now. I imagine we must be close to 200 guests. It's just been absolutely amazing to have so many different people come on and share their insights and their expertise, their lived experience. And I think it really makes both these conversations, but also hopefully encourages other conversations to be happening out there in the world as well. I really hope you enjoy this episode. Here's our conversation. Simon, it's lovely to sit down and have the opportunity to chat with you this evening. How are you? How's your week been?
Well, first of all, thank you, Mike, for inviting me to your podcast. My week is fine. I'm kind of focusing on the book that I've written. Took a long time to write, so now I've got to focus on hoping that people will read it and learn how the brain works and why we get stuck in repetitive patterns all the time.
It was really interesting looking through. Obviously, before guests come on, usually I have a chance to do a little bit of background reading. I try not to read too much because I feel like it sort of spoils the conversation sometimes if I know too many things. But just seeing some of the things where you're talking about sort of patterned behavior, I think is really interesting, because very often when guests come on, well, like, we have a particular thing that we're talking about, whether it's lived experiences, certain campaigns or illnesses. And I think the bits I've picked up on around patterns are, this is something that affects kind of, if not everything, then most things, in terms of our well-being, whether it be in relation to like a mental health illness or not. So it's a really interesting topic to, I think, hear more about. But before we kind of like jump into it, it'd be interesting to hear, are there kind of things that you're doing recently, like we're recording this at the end of February, we're about to go into March, that are supporting your well-being right now as we're kind of coming out of winter sort of time, we're moving into spring? What sort of things are helping support your well-being at the moment?
Okay, so the way I support my well-being is I use a lot of the techniques that I've come across in the last sort of 30 years. Some are really simple, like getting into the kind of what's called the flow zone, you know, sports and activities that you just become fully immersed in. So whatever your mind is doing, it has a break, a distraction, and you're just at one with the activity. Because as we know, minds literally have a mind of their own. And I also do meditation, just 15 minutes a day, where I kind of just watch what's going on in my mind, and that helps me realize that nearly every single thought I have and other people have, they're automatic. They just pop out. They just pop out somewhere in the brain, and we think we thought them, but when you kind of develop an observer perspective, you see that they just appear, and sometimes we like them and sometimes we don't. So watching that process kind of helps me understand what's going on more.
Well, it's a lot of kind of thinking and reflecting as well as part of that, to be able to, I don't know if monitor is the right word, but I guess observe kind of how your well-being is at any point in time as well.
Yeah, that's really important, because with any pattern that we become stuck in, if we don't have awareness that actually we are stuck in a repetitive pattern, we certainly don't have the opportunity to try and break or change that pattern or create a new one, because we're unconscious. We're just acting on automatic, which is what the brain does so brilliantly, because it wants to conserve energy all the time. And so it will put everything it can into a default mode. But it doesn't help us, and it certainly doesn't make us happy. But it doesn't really, that's not its function. Its function is to help us survive, to enable, you know, back in the day, that we survive predators and things like that. And it's still, you know, we still have this ancient apparatus in a modern digital world. And yeah, it's pretty troublesome. It's pretty hard.
And you touched on that idea of patterns there as well. And I know your book has just come out, so we've got Breaking Bad Patterns. Can you tell us a little bit about kind of the insight to how the book started, or how your thought process started when writing?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Where do I start? Well, I think it kind of started back in the 80s when I was doing a psychology degree, and I was listening to lecturers talk about Jung and Freud. And Freud talked about the repetition compulsion, but I just didn't buy into his theory, which I won't go into detail, but it's a bit antiquated, and it just didn't make sense on a personal level. And since that time, I've been trying to figure out why we become stuck in loops like Groundhog Day. And so about 7 years ago, I was on holiday, and I was sort of drawing these little diagrams, trying to sort of figure out, okay, let's see if we can figure out how patterns occur. And it sort of started from that day. That's when the kind of book idea started. And I thought, I'm going to figure this out. I'm going to come up with a model, which is part two of Breaking Bad Patterns, the pattern decoding model, where people can answer a series of questions and kind of see if they found a pattern. And it's a subjective process, but it becomes fairly clear that yes or no, am I in a pattern or not? Because the brain is an association machine, and so it's always comparing now to then. And it's trying to predict the future, and it uses what's happened in the past to predict what's going to happen next. So if you've got out-of-date software in the past, all your programming from childhood and everything else, that is what it uses to predict your future. And then, hey presto, you think, feel, and behave in the present in a way that recreates your past. Mm. It's a bit unfair, really, but that's what happens. And so I just became a bit obsessed with writing this book to try and come up with this model to help people see if they are stuck in a pattern. And then, of course, once you determine you're in a pattern, then you've got a choice. Do I want to break this pattern?
And then kind of as you were talking through then, it sort of prompted a thought in my head of, if our kind of lived experience creates these reactions or learning points maybe in our mind, and these are reinforcing patterns, and then so our future behavior is to some extent dictated by that past trauma or lived experience, is it possible that that can happen even if we don't remember at the time, like if we've blocked out some of that trauma, or if it's from a situation or experience that was from a time when we were younger and we maybe don't remember it, but it's still somehow dictating how we behave and react?
Yeah, absolutely. There are memories called implicit memories, which essentially are memories that are very potent, but we can't consciously recall them, but they're still there. And so when there's a day-to-day trigger, say like a soldier has been at war and lots of horrible things have happened, some they remember, some they don't, and you know, a firework goes off, the brain just reacts and it refers back to those memories, and it doesn't matter if you remember them or not, it still makes a match, and then the person reacts to that firework as if it's a gun going off or something. So yeah, basically, it does seem that maybe all our memories are kind of like recorded, in that there are about 20 people in the world who can remember every day of their lives.
Wow.
And so that kind of gives us a clue that maybe that a lot more, that it is all there and the brain can refer to it. It's just we can't consciously access it. And the more painful a memory is, they become disassociated. And disassociation is a protective mechanism to keep that pain away from us. So people just can't remember. They've got a vague sense that something really bad happened, but they just can't access it.
Yeah, I feel like I quite often say, I know that, but I don't remember it, or I can't remember it. And it's like, there's that knowledge is there, but you just can't recollect it. And I think, I feel like that, for me personally, that's such a common thing just in general life. And that's without the added sort of trauma elements that we're talking about in regards to certain lived experiences that mean both kind of within your mind or within your body, you have protected yourself for whatever reason to forget those things. There's going to be so many bits that are so many experiences that are, I don't want to say dictating, that feels quite controlling, but that are impacting in on our behaviors and the things that we react to and how we react, that just we have very little chance of remembering all of that. Like you say, if it's 20 people in the world, like what ridiculous percentage is that of people that are able to be that informed on the rest of their life?
Yeah, and for those 20 people, there was a program that then they don't exactly enjoy being able to remember every single day of their lives, because it still feels like it happened yesterday, even though it was 30 years ago, because they've got clarity of being able to being able to remember that. But I think what's important is with the pattern, that the clues are, I mean, you mentioned that feeling, you know, trauma and everything else is a lot stored in the body. So you have these sensations, even though you don't have the conscious recall of a memory, but you just feel it in your body. And that's very common. And then with a pattern, one of the biggest clues, say like if a pattern has been triggered, is that there is a trigger, even if you don't pick it up. It can be a word, it can be anything. And then the emotion that you feel in the present moment is much, much bigger than what is actually going on, because your past memories have been triggered in a way that you get a surge, a wave of emotion coming from the past that comes into the present. And then you typically overreact at that point, or other people would say that person's overreacting. And that's a big clue that, that pattern's been triggered.
Yeah, I often hear the phrase sort of, it's the, it's not in relation to, like the reaction or the response is not in. Oh, I can't remember the phrasing now. basically, like, it doesn't have parity with the thing that has happened. But I also think the thing that sort of feeds into that, as you're kind of touching on that, it's like your lived experience, to some extent, I guess, does then dictate how big a thing that is for you. Like you say, that firework or that noise or that argument, okay, that argument is three tables away in the cafe and doesn't, it's not anyone we know, so the impact to you is minimal. But for someone else that's maybe lived with certain situations at home or in relationships, while that couple or those people having that argument are removed from them, as you're talking through, that trigger is a big thing, because it's not that that's having the impact, it's the memory or the value that's been set or the trauma that's been established inside. And I guess us as the third person or the next person, we're not necessarily aware of that or exposed to that. And that's sometimes where it feels disproportionate. There we go. That's why the reaction sometimes feels disproportionate to the thing that you're seeing, because you're not seeing or experiencing the same thing, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that makes complete sense in that, as you said, if for example, you know, a person's grown up with parents fighting all the time and there's a lot of pain associated with that, then the brain notices, you know, somebody shouting and arguing three tables down, and it will do an instantaneous search and those memories will be triggered. And the person can have what's called an emotional flashback, where part of their past comes into the present. And, you know, at that point, the emotional brain just takes over. You know, that expression, logic, just goes, flies away out the window. It's gone. You know, you can't use logic to overcome the power of the emotional brain. Which is one of the reasons there's 10 cartoons in Breaking Bad patterns done by Gemma Hastler, who's a local illustrator. And they're quite fun because they kind of illustrate this continual struggle between logic and emotion that we all have on a daily basis. And the struggle gets bigger when patterns are triggered.
It's just that interesting thought process to go through, I think, of, for some people listening, it might be that this is kind of ringing a bell for you. But I think also considering maybe some of the conversations that we've been part of and being aware of the different ways that friends, colleagues, family members might have been impacted by some of the things that we're talking about. And like I say, that parity or proportion of how they react to certain situations or conversation points or things that have been mentioned, maybe that's making a bit more sense now because of some of the experiences or the patterns, as Simon says, that we're mentioning now. And I wonder, you've got many, many years of experience doing the things that you're doing, how you first got started with realizing these things in other people. That hopefully people are listening and thinking, oh, actually, I'm now noticing that with some of the conversations I've had, maybe this was in relation to something else, and I might go back and offer some more support or have another conversation with someone. But kind of where did your, I guess, journey start with noticing these patterns and being mindful of the different things that are impacting maybe yourself, but also other people as well?
So in a nutshell, the reason or the how this book was written is it's the end of a journey that began in my childhood that was very, very tough. Nowadays I realize that, you know, if there'd been a diagnosis, it would have been complex PTSD because of the ongoing traumatic experiences that I went through. And also I didn't understand them. I didn't understand my mind. I didn't understand why I kept getting bullied, I kept getting picked on, and just felt so bad all of the time. And that's what drew me into psychology, was just trying to figure it all out, to try and figure out why this happened. And so it was a lifelong journey, but it was based on my personal struggle, because, you know, I know what it's like to live with trauma, with OCD, with depression, social anxiety. You know, I've sort of had lived through a lot of these different things. So it's not, I'm not just sort of talking as a therapist from a kind of like who knows it all. It's lived experience, painful experience that has driven me to understand it all. And now I feel it's time to help others understand it all, because if you don't understand it, your brain will keep repeating what it always does. And so many of the techniques for change are counterintuitive. So they're difficult, and you need to understand what the brain is doing to then use techniques that will work. But they're difficult to do because they are counterintuitive to what we normally do.
No, thank you for sharing that. I think it's really interesting to hear your background and your journey, both being as someone with kind of lived experience of different kind of mental health experiences, but also having a sort of an academic and professional background that you've built through your studying career as well. I think very often I found there are crossovers, but very often it's someone that has had either lived experience or an academic background. I'm just really interested to hear as well kind of how you, I guess, that journey with your kind of academic studies through to your career, and how, while I imagine having that lived experience gives you that added passion, must also come with a balance of kind of managing your own well-being and kind of being more considerate with your kind of professional journey as well, because it's not, I imagine, not just a job to you. It's not just things you're doing. You really care about the experiences that you're sharing and educating people about how to better kind of manage and recognize their own situations with their own well-being and mental health as well.
Yeah, and I think because I've lived with as long as I can remember, you know, a struggle with mental health and feeling good about myself, I kind of got an intuitive sense of what works and what doesn't, and then I would look at the theory to see if that made sense or not. And so many times, even now, I hear people saying thoughts create your emotions. So basically, you're responsible for how you feel. So if you're thinking negatively, you're going to feel bad. So what does that mean? It kind of means it's your fault. That's what a lot of people say without realizing it. And that really frustrated me, because the reality is there's two pathways in the brain. So sometimes emotions come before thoughts, and thoughts don't always create the emotion, and it's not your fault. at all. And I want people to know that, that it's really not your fault when you feel bad. It's your brain is on automatic, and yeah, it's people going around saying just think positively, or just do this. Yeah, it's so all these things sort of like drove me to think, okay, well, I need to put down my experiences and hopefully in a way that makes sense to help people know what's actually going on a lot of the time.
And I think that's where, again, that sort of conversation around patterns and lived experience, I think is a really valuable, from my point of view, is a really valuable thing, because it obviously leans on aspects of kind of mental health illnesses or negative lived experiences. But I think it's also something that kind of everyone can use and reflect on. And often I think we sometimes have this fine line between recognizing the support and conversation that we can have with people that are maybe really struggling and aren't experiencing a great time with their mental health right now, but also kind of supporting and encouraging more people that have okay mental health and okay well-being to like be a bit more mindful of what are the things that could still support that or improve it, but also making sure that I guess okay well-being doesn't become your kind of becoming increasingly anxious, or your low mood sort of once a month is becoming once a week, and really engaging and recognizing some of those, I keep on saying it, patterns, I think is a really important thing for us to look at. Yes, it can support and help people that are really struggling, but also those people that sort of sit, it's not in the middle, it's sort of that are stood by the door, I guess, and better supporting and maybe even educating them on how to manage our own well-being at times when we're not struggling.
Yeah, exactly, because if anyone doesn't understand some of the kind of key concepts of what the brain is doing, you can slip into, I mean, all patterns, the irony is with the pattern is that things you do to try and stop it or prevent things from happening actually recreate it. So, and if you're not conscious of that process, you'll be ever wondering, how come, like, why did that happen again? You know, I'm back here again. Not realizing that you've kind of acted on default in a way that has recreated the pattern. And nowadays it's very sad that there are so many younger people who are anxious about different things, and they're acting with that anxiety by avoiding things that scare them, taking on new things, and not realizing that by avoiding, you're strengthening that anxiety. So that's like a key principle where, you know, avoidance leads to more fear. But if you don't know that, you act with the emotion. The emotion, you know, anxiety will say, run away, don't do it, go and hide. That's what the function of the emotion is. And a lot of the time, and this is such a difficult skill, but it's so, so important, is we need to act opposite to the emotion. I mean, have you had an experience where you just haven't wanted to do something, just feel really flat, but then you go and do it without really wanting to, and you feel better afterwards? That's acting opposite to the emotion, because the emotion, say sadness, depression, will be going, oh, let's just go and lock myself in a room, go under the duvet, or what, you know, watch a box set, shut the world out. But then you feel, you know, that isolation will make people feel worse, because they'll tend to ruminate and their mind will be doing all these different negative things. And so if you don't know that actually this is a point where it's really hard, but I need to act opposite to how I'm feeling. So I maybe need to call that friend and have a chat. Mm. But you won't feel like doing it. And that's where change is hard, because you've got that struggle with the emotion taking you one way and you know you need to go the other way.
It's so hard as well, I think, because you touched on something there, the sort of the isolation or isolated thinking, I think, really makes some of these things that, particularly I think in conversation, can sometimes sound like it's not as much of a struggle to overcome that, but it becomes so intrusive. And a lot of the things that we're talking about are those kind of intrusive thoughts and the negative thoughts that can happen in our brains. And particularly if we are currently with an illness or we are susceptible to that type of thinking, it can be really difficult to break out of that that sort of vicious cycle of negative thinking and like you say, acting against where your brain is going can be a really tricky time. And I think very much is, again, the purpose of having a really strong support network and those people that you can talk to. And again, maybe they are people that have noticed different things with you, and we've talked about patterns. Sometimes there are things that other people notice in us, not just they notice, but sometimes they notice them very quickly, and they're things that we don't, because we're busy being occupied by different things in our life and we're possibly living in our head quite a lot of the time as well. So having that support network is definitely something that I've always advocated for. I wonder, in regards to sort of to these kind of bad patterned thinking, is that something that kind of comes up and that you've recognized, and how does that sort of support network and communication fit into that?
Yeah, that's a really good point, Mike, because one, you know, before in part three of Breaking Bad Patterns, the part three is the 12-week program whereby you use different technique every week and you kind of decide what works for you and what doesn't. But before you start, one of the things is advisable is getting a pattern buddy. So you kind of like find someone else whereby you can do it together. So you can check in with each other each day and say, how are you getting on with this? Are you struggling? Do you need a bit of support? Because it's much harder doing things on our own without connection. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, so much pain comes from rejection, from isolation, from disconnection. And really, all we want is connection. All the people on social media putting all this stuff about perfect lives, they're looking for connection. They're looking to be validated, not realizing that it doesn't really work. But that's what we're looking for. We all want that connection. So yeah, I agree with you totally that, you know, support network is fantastic. And even more so when you're saying about negative thinking, you know, it's recognizing that our brains have a negative bias. That's from evolution. So we're set to negative, and we, dependent on our experiences, we can be pushed more negative. So we have to train our minds to come into the positive. And yeah, that support network, fantastic. It's really, really important.
That's really good to hear, and really interesting to hear the different parts and the different aspects that feed into the work you're doing. I think one thing I also kind of, again, as I scribble my little one word notes as we go through, and one of them is kind of through our conversation, we have very much talked about kind of bad patterns or negative patterns. Are there ways to identify or to focus or kind of change that up a little bit, so we're looking at positive patterns and kind of well-being, and again thinking of those people that maybe they are struggling but maybe they're also kind of in the door of sometimes I'm okay, sometimes I'm not? How do we make, or is it possible to make, some of these patterns positive ones?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, in say, like in this 12-week program I've got weeks 9 to 12, the last sort of 4 weeks, are where you learn to create new positive patterns that are kind of in line of where you want to be. So you use techniques that start to create a new, basically it's like creating a new neural network, so that our brain is so used to going back to the old patterns, which are essentially neural networks, and it will just do it by default. Once we've created new positive patterns, we need to repeat them enough times that the brain starts to use that automatically. And that's why it takes time. But ultimately, yes, we absolutely want to create patterns that match our goals in life, that make you feel happier. I mean, being happy is a kind of like a whole massive topic on its own, but at least being the kind of the best version of yourself going forward, and acting, and this is the key, acting in a way that you feel good, because you can never, you can't control your thoughts and feelings. And that's another myth that's out there, that, you know, control your thoughts, control your feelings. It doesn't work like that, but you can choose how to behave. And that's how you make new positive patterns. If you want to be a kind person, you can start acting in ways that are kind to others and being kind to others.
And I've heard someone's said this to me before. I feel like I've adopted it as my own thing, but I've definitely heard it from someone else. It's like your first thought or your first emotion is a thing that you can't control. It's unconscious, it's involuntary, it's probably based on all of these patterns from our past life. So you can't control that. What we can work to control or better manage or understand are our kind of secondary and third kind of reactions to things. So like you say, if you're feeling anxious, okay, we can't stop the fact that you're feeling anxious, but we can look at how we react to the anxiety that started. Do we kind of accept it and work with it and try and look at different ways to calm ourselves or manage that? Or do we become more panicked about being panicked? And I think it's a really interesting way to think that hopefully for other people, as it has for me, allows us to feel more accepting of some of the negative stuff that happens, whether those are thoughts or experiences we've had. But then also empowers us to go, okay, but there is a thing you can do, and you can work on these secondary and kind of third reactions that you have to different thoughts or experiences that you might be having. And does that kind of fit in with some of the things you've been talking about as well?
Yeah, you must have been reading the first part of part three, because one of the key concepts before you start working with techniques is a kind of paradigm of acceptance and change, because it's sometimes we need to learn to accept certain things because we can't change them, and other times there are things we can change, and it's having the wisdom to know when we can accept something and when we can change something. And going back to what you said, if you have a trigger that makes you feel anxious, you know, you suddenly go and open the door now and there's a tiger outside, your body is going to be filled with fear and panic. You can't control that, it's automatic. But slowly, as your thinking brain starts to come more online, you can make choices what to do next. And that's quite an extreme example, but the idea is that you can slowly choose your response, how you act, despite feeling panic and fear. So, yeah, that's really good analogy that you use there, in that kind of secondary reaction is where you can use acceptance and or change to decide what comes next. But it all comes down to awareness. If you're not aware in the moment, everything will just happen. And it's only later you'll think, why did I act like that? Why did I do this or do that? And that in itself is kind of like the first bigger skill, is starting to practice being more aware in the moment, because that's all that exists is this one moment. But it's difficult. It is difficult, but it can be done with practice.
I like that. You said a couple of times practice there. I think that's so important as well, isn't it? Because sometimes we read a book or listen to a podcast and think, I'm going to do that. And then maybe we're disappointed because we don't immediately make that change. It takes time. And especially if it's something that you're struggling with. And a lot of the stuff we're talking about is people with certain struggles or lived experiences that aren't always great. It can take time to make those changes, and for good reason. So it is about practice. It is about kind of continuing. And I think that's a really positive place for people to reflect on as well, that, you know, maybe you're going to read a book a few times or listen to a conversation or have conversations with friends a few times. You're going to try things a couple of times, and, you know, maybe the first 2, 3, 4, 5 times it doesn't go quite as you had hoped, but that's working towards where you want to be and the change you're working on as well. I think practice is a big thing.
Practice is massive, because you are creating these neural networks. It's repeated and sustained practice of just repeating the things you now want your brain to start doing. And so it's viewing change as a process and a journey, not a quick fix. And so, you know, you have your journal and you, every day you're doing something on that journey, whereas the brain, especially the emotional brain, is always looking for the quick fix, the high, suddenly feel good. I'll just that quick cup of coffee and piece of cake and I feel good. And then of course it wears off. But the evolutionary process is always looking for the quick fix, whereas change is repetition, practice, practice, practice. It's the same as if you were going to train for a marathon, you know, and you've never run before. You can't do it in 3 days. It takes, I don't know how long, but a long time of building up slowly. And it's exactly the same with mental training. It's a lot of practice, and then if you're using techniques that you know that will work, it's persistence, because it's easy to give up when the newness wears off. You start something all excited and then don't really feel much different a week later. That didn't really work. Go and look for something else. And you're constantly jumping from thing to thing. Whereas practice is like, I said there's 60 different techniques in the book. Even if you just do one and you just repeat that over and over again, that's enough to make changes, to change your life, as long as you just practice that particular technique.
Amazing. With that idea of practicing and going through and rereading and rechecking things a few times, there might be people that want to find out a bit more about yourself, Simon, or maybe even pick up the Breaking Bad Patterns book. If they do want to find out more, where are the best places for them to go to find out about you or the book?
Well, the book, the full title, Breaking Bad Patterns, 60 Ways to Free Yourself from a Life Stuck on Repeat, is Amazon is kind of the easiest place to go to, I guess, to buy a copy of the book. I have a website, www.breakingbadpatterns.com, and I do use social media, not very much, but, you know, if anybody wants to drop a message on Twitter or Instagram, yeah, I'm on those as well. I'm not like a massive social media person, but it's a good, they're good contact places, you know, to hear from people. So yeah,
that's nice signposting as well sometimes, isn't it?
Here's
a bit of information if you want more, have a look on the website. I think it's just sort of really interesting conversations, and hopefully a prompt maybe for people that are listening as well to, like we say, reflect on whether it's your own well-being or someone that you've kind of got within your social circle. And if you do want to find out more, go and have a look at Simon's website or pick up the book as well. But thank you so much for coming on and for giving up your time to have a conversation and sharing your insights and expertise as well.
Well, yeah, I've really enjoyed it, Mike, and thank you very much for inviting me. It's just such a massive subject. We've talked for hours.
Yeah, I think we've done very well to be restrained and stick to our time.
These are real people. They do have struggles.
And it starts to get on my nerves. I just shut down.
So many people suffer from mental illness.
To get the word out that men have got to start talking.
A lot of people don't understand the depth of the situation, so they can't appreciate,
It's difficult dealing with our minds. And the suicidal thoughts were back.
People knew that there was something not right, but they just never really said anything, or probably felt like it wasn't their place to say anything.
You're not depressed, it's all in your head. That's probably the statement I've had people say the most.
I mean, this shit is real, and it's hard, it's exhausting.
Sometimes you need somebody to just give you permission.
And I think people realise how helpful that one conversation can be just to figure out why you are feeling the way you are.
Not only did this help me to write it, it potentially might have helped some other people as well. So it sort of started from there.
People just want to know that they're safe to talk and share these things.
So many people think they're alone. And then you hear other people talk about it and they think, oh, that's so brave, or I could relate to that. And then they want to talk about it.